Secrets and Spies presents Espresso Martini with Chris Carr and Matt Fulton.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Espresso Martini. Matt, how are you?
I'm good, Chris. I'm happy to be here, but I'm not going to sugarcoat it. I'm a tired boy.
Oh, dear. Yeah, you've been a busy one this week. You've been doing like lots of interviews. That's good. So we will benefit from your tiredness in some respects.
Yes, it was for a good cause. Yeah, so I spoke to Shane Harris earlier in the week that has been out by the time this airs. It'll been out for a couple days. We talked about the Iran intelligence pre and post strike, and also Tulsi Gabbard's sort of quagmire that she's in over at DNI. And then yesterday, as we're recording this, I interviewed Joe Cirincione, who's a well-known arms control and nuclear non-proliferation expert in DC. He's been in all kinds of think tanks, appears on CNN once in a while. So I got sort of in the weeds with him on like the details of what parts of the nuclear program were destroyed, and sort of if Iran rushes for a bomb, what's like their most path of least resistance to do so. So that's really cool. I'm excited for folks to hear that. That'll be out next Wednesday. And then coming up the following weekend, we haven't recorded this yet, but I don't anticipate any scheduling issues here. I'm talking to Tim Weiner about his new book, his sequel to Legacy of Ashes. It's called The Mission, the CIA in the 21st Century. So I'm still working on that, but I'm excited to talk to him. So lots of good stuff coming up.
Yeah, well, congratulations on both your interviews, and I'm looking forward to the Tim Weiner one, and I thought the one with Shane Harris was very good.
Thank you.
It does sound like that Tulsi Gabbard's days may be numbered, so listeners should go and check that out. And also, it was very interesting just listening about some of the intelligence summaries about the Iran nuclear program, and the idea that even though they'd got it to, was 60% enrichment, that you kind of like, there's a situation where you don't really, you know, there is definitely not for peaceful means that enrichment. There's definitely something going to happen with it. And it's just a question of will it happen or won't it? And so, yeah.
It's coming right up to the line and doing everything you would need to do to build a nuclear weapon without actually making the decision to do so. And that's sort of, you know, you could see how that is sort of still not a great position to be in if you're looking at this from, you know, the Israeli or the US point of view. But yeah, really great conversation there. I encourage folks to go check it out if they haven't already.
Yeah, do. Thank you for that. So our first story is about the NATO summit. So I'll just quickly draw from an article by Chatham House, which is titled "The Five Key Priorities for NATO After the Summit." So as the NATO summit in The Hague concluded, European leaders likely returned home relieved. There was no major upheaval, and even Trump appeared warmer towards his NATO peers. This year's summit had low ambition. The agenda was deliberately shortened to minimize potential disruption, and Ukraine was decoupled to avoid public clashes between Trump and Zelensky. The Netherlands and NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte gave Trump a warm welcome. Allies agreed to spend 5% on GDP on defense, including 3.5% on core defense and 1.5% on resilience, cybersecurity, and infrastructure. The summit also marked the start of shifting the burden of European defence from the US to Europe. However, Spain sparked controversy by stating that it won't be able to meet the agreed-upon 5% NATO spending target and instead committed to just 2.1% of its GDP, and this has fueled concerns about burden sharing and the alliance unity. Looking ahead, the article from Chatham House proposes that NATO needs to focus on five key issues that weren't addressed at the summit. So the first issue is the support for Ukraine. Then it's continuing the review of NATO's strategic approach to Russia as agreed at last year's summit. Then preparing for possible US troop reductions in Europe. Then building industrial capacity. Ukraine has shown how vital it is to have a defense industrial base ready to innovate and scale in a crisis. And then deepening engagement with NATO's Indo-Pacific four partners, which is South Korea, Japan, New Zealand, and Australia, especially as relations appear to be cooling in that area at the moment. This summit was all about footing the bill for the return to collective defence and beginning the burden shift to Europe, but the real work begins now, planning, implementation and execution. NATO must tread carefully, and the alliance can't afford unnecessary risks with President Trump ahead of next year's summit, and the article even calls whether there should be a summit next year or whether they should make them more less frequent to avoid any problems with Trump. So, Matt, what are your thoughts on all of this?
Did you hear the text message that, or did you see, I guess, the text message that Ruiz sent Trump right before the Ooh. Summit? Trump posted a screenshot of it on Truth Social. It wasn't good form. Do you want to hear it?
Yeah.
All right, I'll read it.
Sounds interesting. Who sent the text message there?
Mark Rutte, the Secretary General of NATO, sent this text to Trump, while Trump was on his way to the summit, and Trump posted a screenshot of this on his Truth Social, which is bad form, but that's what he does. So it says, "Mr. President, dear Donald, congratulations and thank you for your decisive action in Iran. That was truly extraordinary and something no one else dared to do. It makes us all safer. You are flying into another big success in The Hague this evening. It was not easy, but we've got them all signed on the 5%. Donald, you have driven us to a really, really important moment for America and Europe and the world. You will achieve something no American president in decades could get done. Europe is going to pay in a big way, again, all caps, as they should, and it will be your win. Safe travels and see you at His Majesty's dinner." Signed, Mark Rutte.
Wow. We have a term for that in the UK, if you want to hear it.
What is that?
Brown nosing.
Yeah. So he took, Rutte took a lot of flack for this, at least as I saw, I think this might be I have thoughts on the policy of the summit as well, but I mean, the Trump factor here, like, will there, won't there be an issue, was sort of looming large over the whole thing. And thankfully, there really wasn't an issue with him there. So this might be an unpopular opinion, but I think what Rutte is doing there, navigating and handling Trump, is really smart. If you're the NATO Secretary General, your first job is to keep NATO alive, right? That text, where he basically says, congratulations on being the biggest, smartest, most specialist boy. Yes, it was sycophantic and brown nosing, as you said. Yes, it was cringe, especially for folks in Europe to hear, no doubt. But I think it was also shrewd. As I've said on here before, the Transatlantic Alliance has to keep its eye on a much longer game right now, or at least a game that lasts longer than 3.5 years. Putin and all these authoritarian goons flatter and manipulate Trump constantly. Why shouldn't Rutte do the same for good? Macron does it pretty well. You don't have to like it, but I don't like it. It's annoying and exhausting, but I get it. With Trump, everything is transactional. Everything is about personal vibes. If you don't have that relationship, you don't play that game, then you're cooked. And it's that chumminess, that feigned subservience, and I think Rutte is smart enough to know what he's doing there, even if Trump doesn't know what he's doing, that feigned subservience that might linger in Trump's mind if and when J.D. Vance starts musing about blowing up the whole alliance. So, I see some merit there.
I agree with you, and Politico actually stated that Mark Rutte has cracked the code for a successful leaders summit involving President Trump. Call him daddy, basically, is what they said. And sadly, that's kind of the age we live in. And I get what you're saying. It is frustrating that it's kind of come to that. But I think, like you have said about how authoritarian leaders like Putin, etc., always manipulate Trump, so it's better to manipulate him for good. I think the problem is, for some people, is obviously there's still no guarantee that it will work, and then you lose a lot of sort of, should we say, personal capital by kind of brown nosing in that way sometimes. So it worked for him on this occasion, but it could in another occasion backfire. But that's his job. It's his job, yeah.
It's certainly not guaranteed to work. I think it's objectively better than the alternative, which would almost certainly result in nothing good for the alliance. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, getting through a NATO summit with Trump without drama, without chaos, without anyone lighting the curtains on fire, I mean, that's a win. It functioned. It was almost boring. You know, take that win. That's also now one fewer summit where European leaders have to white knuckle their way through the agenda and hope he doesn't tweet something insane. And I think maybe even what we saw is a model for how these, you know, summits, especially as far as, you know, NATO is concerned, which Trump historically has a lot of sort of skepticism and reason to be, well, not reason, but is want to be prickly towards. I think this is a good model for maybe how to handle it productively. And you know, while the political summit was basically just a well choreographed effort to keep Trump from blowing the place up, there was a productive summit also happening in parallel off stage. So first, as you said in your intro, Europe is finally starting to build some real defense muscle. NATO members, you said, committed to spending 5% of GDP on defense and resilience by 2035, which, yes, believe it when we see it. But if it happens, it's a big deal. It won't replace the U.S., but it does get Europe closer to the point where they can hold the line in the Baltics without having to wait and see if a U.S. president doesn't feel like answering the phone. Hopefully not, but it's a reality we have to contend with as long as we find ourselves in it. Second, Ukraine's defense industry is becoming central to Europe's, and I love that. There's a growing push behind what's being called the Danish model, so directly investing in Ukrainian arms production. It's fast, it's scalable, and the stuff Ukraine builds today might help rearm Europe tomorrow. It might help us help the U.S. in Taiwan at some point in the future. And third, there's, you know, also a quiet recognition that the U.S. footprint in Europe is going to shrink, maybe not this year, maybe not next, but I think the writing's on the wall there. Those post-invasion of Ukraine numbers that surged toward NATO's eastern flank under Biden in 2022 and onward, I don't think that probably wouldn't have been sustainable indefinitely, even under a different administration, far more friendly to the transatlantic you know, relationships there, especially if the Pacific gets more dicey in years ahead. So that means Europe's got to start covering for some of the U.S. enablers there, intelligence, assets, refueling, airlift, missile defense, stuff absolutely critical in a great power war. So that's sort of, you know, the meat, the policy side that I sort of liked from this.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think, you know, the conference wisely focused on getting Europe in better shape for its defense against Russia, because there is still open talk about there might be direct confrontation with Russia within the next decade, which is a worrying thought. And obviously, getting Europe in better shape for its own defense has been at the forefront of Trump's foreign policy. And I'll give the Trump admin credit for that, as I think we, you know, both agreed, and you just said it, that this was needed. And Europe has become way too reliant on America for its collective defense. And, you know, post the 1990s, many domestic defense capabilities had been allowed to slide as governments made cutbacks, thinking that defense was no longer a priority in the way it was during the Cold War. Obviously, Russia's annexation of Crimea for some was a warning, and then its invasion of Ukraine in 2022 became a direct threat. And thankfully, many governments have realized this. I don't think Trump's threats in the past to withdraw US support from NATO or even come out of NATO completely have been helpful. He always does appear to take these maximalist positions to get what he wants, which is not unlike Vladimir Putin, who has been using the same tactics during these sort of so-called peace negotiations between Russia and Ukraine, which appear to have gone a little bit quiet as of late. And I have huge concerns on the public reaction to this sort of 5% GDP commitment. At least in the UK, I've seen many left-leaning commentators sort of my age group and slightly older who seem to suffer from what I call late 90s thinking or post-Iraq cynicism, in which they view any increased defense spending as warmongering and just lining the pockets of the industrial military complex. These people somehow believe we do not live in a world of increased military risks, which we have seen over the last decade, and they view any risks as just sort of manufactured in some way by our governments akin to Orwell's 1984. And I think all of that's not very helpful. The current UK government, the Labour-led government, are obviously at the moment having issues with regards to their sort of domestic social security spending. They've been having umming and ahhings about that. And I think that kind of unfortunately plays a little bit into the idea that there's always money for weapons, but never enough money for sort of social issues like the NHS, etc., and social security. So that's there's definitely going to be similar conversations in other European countries too. And I think there definitely needs to be a concerted effort to get the public on board with defence, you know, because increased military spending will probably be unpopular across quite a few European countries as domestic welfare and the cost of living increases. And I'm interested to see how each member is going to be able to spend this 5% GDP on defence and justify it to the populations. So, yeah, there's a lot of interesting kind of choppy waters to navigate, you know, between now and when those defence commitments due to kick in, because they're not due to kick in until, is it 2030 something? I actually can't remember now, somewhere in the 2030s that they've actually got to commit to spending this 5% GDP. So it's a little bit of a way to go just yet. One other thing as well, cost of living. So cost of living is a massive debate in Europe, and it's obviously a big debate in the US at the moment. And I think, like, you know, I think we've said this sort of before. I've certainly said it before. I think we need to treat it. The cost of living crisis should be considered a national security threat, or at least a threat to democracy, because history has shown and current events have shown populations struggling financially to survive increasingly turn to authoritarianism to resolve those issues. It didn't end well for Germany in the 30s, and it's not going to end well for any of us now.
I think one can make that same argument here in the US.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't see that getting any easier, because, you know, we've got the effects of climate change, which is going to disrupt food, energy and water supplies. And governments and individuals can put their heads in the sands about this for a long, you know, as long as they like. But time is running out on that side of things, too. And I'm just worried that during the 2030s and 40s, we're going to see an open conflict for basic resources. And some argue that is already going on. And I partially agree with that. The desire for minerals and possibly fuel is definitely a factor in some conflicts we see right now. So I think there's a lot of interesting things ahead, really, that ultimately, tying it back to NATO, is just regarding these 5% defence commitments. I believe each member nation faces the challenge of persuading its population that defence is an essential and as worthy of an investment as healthcare, education and social support. You know, we have a lock on our front door for a reason. It's to protect what matters to us. And in the same way, defense spending is a bit like that lock on the nation's door. So there we go.
Yeah. On the defense spending issue, I know it certainly gets more popular. Polling on this gets more popular the farther east you go in NATO, so the closer to Russia, where they understand the threat, you know, far greater than folks in the farther west you go. I mean, those, you know, tanks and missiles are going to be hitting there before they hit you know, parts of London and France, you know, per se. But I think I don't unfortunately have any exact numbers right in front of me here. I believe though that the increase in defense spending in Germany is at least not unpopular.
Yes. Yeah. I remember you saying that. Yeah.
Which is good. And I think at least, you know, for the continent, if the German public is on board there and the German government is sort of leading the way in that sort of increase in defense spending, that sort of rearmament, I think for the continent, that sort of, I mean, you know, the German industrial base, the German economy, it sort of revs up the engine for the whole whole continent sort of follow suit, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting that change has happened, because I think Germany, in a weird way, statistically, was quite anti-defense spending for some time, and the population was.
Quite a
change. And also they were quite anti-American as well. I remember during the sort of Snowden period, it felt like anti-Americanism reached quite a big peak in Germany during that period. And then it sort of, I think the Ukraine war mainly in mainland Europe has shaken more people than maybe in the UK. It's a bit of a generalization, but I think for people who are in mainland Europe, it's a lot more real than for us on England, you know, because we're, you know, we've got the channel and the channel only protects us so much. But I think a lot more countries, a lot more countries are realizing that this threat from Russia is no longer academic. And, you know, and also Russia's been very aggressive on the sort of cyber side of things. And we've all seen how social media has sort of been manipulated to cause sort of infighting within our own communities. And we're still living through that now. And I think a lot of people, if they're smart about it, are right to be pissed off about Russia right now. So the tide is turning a little bit at the moment about that sort of apathy. But I do feel, I still feel it's quite popular, certainly in leftist circles in the UK and people who are very influential in sort of filmmaking, etc. People who I kind of know who do reflectively believe that somehow that defence spending is all just to make more money for the defence industrial complex and stuff. And I think that's quite a sort of cynical view of it. But there we go.
Perhaps this is a bit flippant of me, but I think maybe they don't know what we know.
Quite possibly. I think the more time I spend on this, yeah, it's difficult. You've got to be careful not to become paranoid or whatever. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the more time you spend looking at what's going on, you do start to see, you do see how aggressive Russia is and how a lot of the time it's felt like we've been on the back foot for some time. And also I think collectively in UK leftist circles, I remember talking about this with Meredith Tax, my first interview, when we talked about like how you get, sorry, go a bit off topic here, but where you get like leftists who end up supporting jihadists, and a lot of leftists still see America as the great imperial bad guy in the world. And so there's this sort of reflexiveness to just be a bit, anything America says or does or anything Britain does, they're suspicious of it. And they feel that there's always ill intent behind it. And, there are times where we're not the good guys. Iraq probably being a very good case in point, where we definitely had some very questionable sort of reasons for going in. But you just got to be, I think you've always got to take everything on a kind of case-by-case basis, because if you just constantly believe that everything that Britain and America does is just flat wrong, you'll be right some of the time, but you're going to be wrong other times. And when you are wrong, it's going to be important to you, because it'd be your community on the front line that faces the consequences of being wrong in that assumption, if that makes any sense. But complex times ahead with that debate. I'm sure we'll come back to it on future episodes, and I wouldn't mind trying to maybe get some guests on to talk to us a bit more about defense spending and the whole and the industrial military complex. There's this term that gets thrown around, and is that famous Eisenhower warning about it and stuff that people like to quote. And there was a really good episode of War on the Rocks about 5 or 10 years ago about the blob and in defense of the blob, which is the sort of defense complex. And I'd just love to sort of go more into that on maybe future episodes and sort of demystify some of the myths behind it that lead to some of these sort of grand statements that people make about it. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think sort of last point from me on this, and maybe also in line with that, you know, just bearing in mind the complex times that we are in. You know, again, I know this will be unpopular with some, but I don't care. I will die on this hill. If Mark Rutte texting Trump every now and then to say, "Mr. President, dear Donald, how'd you get so cute?" is what keeps SACEUR, the Supreme Allied Commander Europe, in Mons, the international staff in Brussels, and the entire rest of the NATO command structure operating more or less undisturbed until January 20th, 2029. That is a massive win for the free world, and yeah. Rutte will deserve a medal. And with that, you know, you all may throw your rotten tomatoes at me now.
No, that's fine. And if somebody can find a way to persuade Trump to turn down some of the pro-Russian rhetoric in MAGA and maybe some of the anti-NATO rhetoric in MAGA, that would be a good objective as well over the next 3.5 years.
Yeah. Gotcha. Well, on high that, task there.
It is. It is indeed a very hard task, but there we go. Well, let's take a quick break and we'll come back for more. Welcome back, everybody. So, Matt, you want to chat to us about the presidential war powers, and you picked out two very interesting articles about this, because there's been obviously a lot of debate about this since the US actions against Iran's nuclear program. So I'll hand over to you.
Yeah. So, of course, 2 weeks now after President Trump ordered a sweeping U.S. military strike on Iran, coordinated across more than 100 aircraft, a submarine, and dozens of precision-guided munitions, we're circling back to a question we've gotten from listeners, especially our non-American listeners. Did the president actually have the legal authority to do this? Now, we didn't really cover this question in any detail during the last two espresso martinis that we discussed the Iran strikes. For my part, that's because we had plenty to handle already. I'm not a legal analyst, and this subject can get insanely complicated. And though it should, I don't believe this issue just objectively has any bearing on what happens now following these strikes. And I'll explain that at length going forward. You know, we can get more into that later, Chris, if you'd like. But if folks would like it addressed, I'll brush up on it and we'll make time to talk about it here. I've also, as you said, I've also left some helpful articles from the Project on Government Oversight and the National Constitution Center in the show notes. So definitely check those out for more. So here we go. An explainer on presidential war powers as best I understand it. So, under the Constitution, war powers reside squarely with Congress. Article 1, Section 8, and again, so I mainly geared towards non-U.S. listeners. So there are seven articles in the Constitution. Article 1 lays out the legislative branch, which is Congress, and all of its authorities and responsibility. Article 2 lays out the executive branch, which is the president, all of his or her responsibilities. And powers, and you know, all the federal government departments and everything that sort of flows from that authority. So for our purposes today, we're just focusing on Articles 1 and 2. So Article 1, Section 8 gives the legislative branch, not the executive, the sole authority to declare war. The framers were explicit that decisions to use force should rest with the branch most accountable to the people. That principle was tested and many would argue breached when the White House launched the B-2s without congressional authorization or even the customary advance briefing to leadership in the House and the Senate. Of course, you know, this wasn't merely a drone strike or even some classified JSOC escapade. It was a highly choreographed, large-scale military operation targeting Iranian nuclear facilities carried out in the midst of an ongoing regional war. As for the legal basis, it was the usual fallback used by every administration. Article 2 powers and the president's role as commander-in-chief. But that logic doesn't really withstand a lot of legal scrutiny. So the key statute here is the War Powers Resolution of 1973, passed by Congress in the wake of Vietnam to reassert its constitutional authority. That law, which was passed by two-thirds of both the House and the Senate, overriding Nixon's veto, says a president can introduce U.S. forces into hostilities only under three conditions. So that's a formal declaration of war, a specific statutory authorization, like an authorization for use of military force or an AUMF. I'll go more into that a bit later. Or a national emergency created by an attack on the United States or its armed forces. So that's not merely the threat of a potential attack in the future. It's an attack in actuality. And here's where a common misconception comes in. The idea that presidents can lawfully commit troops to combat for up to 60 days without congressional approval. That's not what the law says. The 60-day clock is not a free pass. It's a restraint. So it applies only after the president has already met one of those three legal justifications for deployment. If the president acts without that legal basis, then even the 60 days don't apply, and the action itself is unlawful from the start. So here's a recent example of where I think the 60-day provision would have applied, also involving Iran. So in 2019, Iran, under Trump's first term, Iran shot down a Global Hawk surveillance drone over the Strait of Hormuz. Iranians said it was in their airspace. We said, no, it wasn't. Trump ordered retaliatory strikes on Iranian radar and missile sites, relatively limited in isolation, but theoretically could have put us into an escalatory spiral. And he called that off 10 minutes to weapons release. So in that scenario, as stupid as risking a war over a flying camera would have been, downing the Global Hawk constituted an attack on U.S. forces. Trump would have had 60 days to conduct operations and either cease them or seek congressional approval to go further. In this case, Iran did not. In this case, a couple weeks ago, Operation Midnight Hammer, Iran did not attack U.S. forces first. That is not what happened. His legal footing then was much more solid than it is here. So still, presidents from both parties have long sidestepped Congress on questions of war and peace. Reagan in Grenada, Clinton in Kosovo, Obama in Libya, Trump in Syria, and now Iran, Biden in the Red Sea. Now, each administration had elaborate legal arguments for why their specific operation did not need congressional approval under the War Powers Resolution. I won't get into the specifics on those cases because it's way beyond my comfort zone and probably the scope of this podcast. Lawfare's published reams on this if folks really want to get into the weeds there. In some cases, administrations leaned on threadbare or outdated AUMFs, like the post-9/11 or 2002 Iraq War authorization. So for some additional context there, the 2001 AUMF aimed at al-Qaeda and its affiliates is still used to legally justify our limited presence in Syria for counter-ISIS operations and protecting Kurdish-controlled oil fields. Because remember, ISIS was born from al-Qaeda in Iraq, right? So it you know, shares that same sort of cellular DNA. It's also been used to justify military deployments in not just Afghanistan, but the Philippines, Georgia, Yemen, Djibouti, Kenya, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Iraq, and Somalia. As to the full extent of which groups the Pentagon believes qualify as an al-Qaeda affiliate, that's classified. So you see the opacity there. Expiration dates and precise language really matter with these things, as we've learned. In other cases, administrations argue that their Article II powers give them inherent authority to protect U.S. interests abroad, such as the White House here in claiming that the Iranians that the Iranian nuclear program posed an imminent threat. Congress, for its part, has often failed to challenge these moves, and each time it doesn't, the precedent deepens. So that pattern held here with Iran. In the immediate aftermath, before it was clear whether this would devolve into something bigger and more open-ended, a bipartisan handful of lawmakers introduced resolutions to block further unilateral action by the president. Those efforts went nowhere because congressional leadership are beholden to him, to the president, and didn't want to. So despite consistent bipartisan concern, there's always little political will to confront the executive branch on war powers, especially when military action is sold as swift, successful, and limited. And that's the heart of the matter. Whether or not Congress would have authorized the strikes is almost beside the point. What's clear is that it didn't, and the Constitution still expects it to. The legal framework is there. The War Powers Resolution is on the books. But without congressional enforcement, these are little more than suggestions on pieces of paper. The real question then isn't whether this strike violated the War Powers Resolution. I think it's whether a critical mass of Congress ever intends to enforce it, because as long as lawmakers treat war powers as optional, presidents will keep treating them as their own. So to anyone looking at this, perhaps from abroad, and asking how could the Constitution allow this, it doesn't. But the only people with the power to enforce the law here have simply declined to do so. And come January 2027, they'll, in all likelihood, lose that power. But I want to underscore here that this problem in our politics did not begin with and is certainly not unique to Donald Trump. It goes back decades, a true bipartisan abdication and indulgence. So, Chris, there you go.
Yeah, unfortunate precedent has been set up by former presidents who have abused their authority. And what Trump is quite good at is using those things sometimes as a justification for his own behavior. And critics of Trump sometimes make the mistake of making it out that Trump's the only one who does these things. So it's a kind of complicated situation, really. One question I have is, am I right that obviously the Operation Midnight Hammer is technically, he has violated the presidential war powers. He's violated that. Is that right?
Yeah. The presidential war powers resolution. Yeah, he's violated the letter of it. I mean, every president has since, you know, Reagan.
Yeah. And so domestically at the moment, does he actually face any legal or political consequences for this?
No. And that's why I sort of said at the top, you know, I didn't really talk about it much earlier because I just think there's more important stuff to talk about and convey to people, because he's not, like, nothing's going to come of that. If Operation Midnight Hammer turned into a multi-week, you know, multi-strike, coming back again and again and again, hitting different targets, bringing in additional forces, perhaps causing U.S. casualties, right? So mission creep, right? If it was still going on, then I think, even with the way Congress is, I think they would have sort of run into a wall eventually, and they would have had to pass some sort of AUMF. I also think the case is pretty good that they could have gotten the votes in Congress, you know, enough Republicans, even the parts of the MAGA base who are, you know, isolationist and skeptical of foreign entanglements, them aside. Also, you know, there would certainly be, in principle, I think, many Democrats who would vote against it. But I think there would be plenty of sort of centristy kind of Democrats and everything who could picture enough Republicans and Democrats voting for an AUMF
right now on
Iran's nuclear program to have passed it. But I mean, it was, as far as we know, sitting here right now, it was Operation Midnight Hammer, and that's it. You know, so yeah, if it, to answer your question simply, if it had kept going, you know, then he would have ran into that issue, and they probably would have had to pass something. I don't think they could have done it. They could have gone in indefinitely with no justification. But no, just what we saw the other week, no, there's not. Nothing's going to come of it.
Yeah, I think it's pretty fair to say there's a reasonable amount of cross-party concern about Iran's nuclear program, where they probably would have got the votes to take it. But I suppose what's kind of concerning, as an outsider looking in, it does seem to be a pattern of behavior with the Trump administration of just bypassing a lot of checks and balances that, like Biden, et cetera, made an effort to use the majority of the time when they did something. And this operation kind of, I don't think it's as reckless as some people make it out to be. And I don't think it's as ill thought out as some people like to make it out to be either. I think it was actually quite well planned and executed, and was, you know, and it probably did its best to minimize casualties because it was focusing mainly on military and targets.
I don't think anyone on the ground was, I think 600 people were killed in the Israeli strikes over the course of those 2 weeks that I've heard. But the U.S. strike on those three nuclear sites, I don't believe anyone was killed on the ground. Those sites were long evacuated.
No, indeed. So yeah. So just back to my point, I think a lot of people are just concerned that it feels like the Trump administration is just bypassing things, and there's way too much sort of power with the executive branch at the moment. And I think that's, you know, that's not just over this, it's over a lot of issues that we're seeing.
Well, let's take a look at how that sort of happens and how we got there, where the executive branch has sort of so much power. I mean, there's that sort of, it's not really a joke, but I guess it's more of a critique that, you know, we elect a king every 4 years. And again, this is before, this predates Trump. It's not a Republican or Democrat issue. This is an every president issue. So yeah, so I think one of the clearest case studies in how this war powers debate tends to fall apart in practice, and how the sort of situation that we're in here with it sort of calcifies, we could look at Syria 2013 and Obama's red line debacle, if you like. So after Assad's regime carried out a massive sarin gas attack on civilians near Damascus, President Obama faced a quandary. He'd previously drawn a red line. Chemical weapons use would change his calculus on U.S. intervention in the Civil War. And in the wake of that attack, his NSC signaled imminent strikes against Syrian targets, right? But here's where it gets interesting and also revealing. So despite earlier actions, like in Libya, where Obama had bypassed Congress, part of the administration's argument there was the operations in Libya were actually a NATO-run mission, not a U.S.-led mission, which is, you know, you can debate that all you want, but that's what they were claiming. So this time Obama did something different. He paused and asked Congress to authorize a use of force. So legally, the administration argued he could act under Article 2. Remember, that's the executive branch and presidential powers for everything, as previous presidents have done. But politically, and I think in part out of his desire to do things by the book, right, this sort of cautious, contemplative constitutional law professor that Obama is, he threw the decision back to Congress. And what did Congress do? Nothing. They froze. They punted. And it wasn't just that there wasn't consensus. It was that many in that building did not want to publicly be on the hook for a yes or a no, especially not after Iraq and Afghanistan. So public support for another Middle East intervention was low, and politically there was no upside. Some Republicans went so far as to threaten impeachment if Obama struck without authorization. And these weren't just, you know, Tea Party kooks in the House. John McCain said Obama could be impeached if he put troops on the ground. And he's Obama since said that was a major factor in his decision making here. So but when Obama actually did that, when he asked Congress to step up, debate the issue and vote, they backed away. Members on both sides of the aisle didn't want to take the heat. They didn't want to be seen as weak on national security and U.S. credibility, but they also didn't want to endorse military action that could have proven unpopular. So they chose the easiest option, which is paralysis, right? So can't be criticized if you never pick a side. Smart. And with Congress ducking the question, Obama took a false diplomatic off-ramp, accepting a Russian-brokered deal to remove Syria's declared chemical weapons stockpile, which was a scam. Numerous chemical attacks followed in that war. And let's be honest about what caused it. Congress had the opportunity to assert their constitutional authority and make a decision about war and peace, and it chose not to. So the result? The red line wasn't enforced. U.S. credibility took a hit, and we added another entry to the growing list of precedents in which Congress abdicates responsibility and the president acts or doesn't act alone. So the second and third order consequences of that inaction reached far beyond Syria, too. It helped give rise to ISIS, destabilizing the entire region and necessitating another massive U.S.-led war to stop them. It stoked a migration crisis for Europe, which surely was a factor in the outcome of Brexit and the broader far-right populist movement sweeping the West. In many respects, we're still suffering from the fallout, but Obama was not the sole author of this failure, and I think history seems to be forgetting that a bit. It's easy to point fingers at presidents for executive overreach, and especially executive inaction, and often those criticisms are valid, but when Congress won't even take a vote, won't do the job the Constitution and their voters assigned to them, then their complaints are just hollow whining. If Congress wants to reclaim their authority to decide when and where we go to war, then they must assert themselves and demand it. Otherwise, we'll keep seeing the same pattern play out again and again. So, put up or shut up, Congress critters.
Yeah, indeed. And the more feckless Congress are, the more critics of government who want small government get ammunition to say that they're useless, you know, and all the kind of stuff about bureaucracy, etc. People love to kind of cite to justify reckless actions or actions that don't take due process. It's a complicated one. There was one other thing that came in via email that partially probably inspired what you have just shared with us. Do you think that these strikes were a distraction by Trump? Do you think he chose to do it to distract from other issues that are kind of going on domestically at the moment? Because some people have accused Trump of doing that.
No, because it didn't distract from that. You know, okay, what are the domestic issues that are sort of, you know,
not being talked about? Yeah,
I don't know if he would say they're causing problems for him, but they are causing problems for him. You know, look like immigration, all these sort of, you know, domestic issues that are simmering in the background. They're still doing that. Iran didn't change that. You know, I think he got sort of swept up in the Fox News sort of triumphalistic coverage of the Israeli operations. Didn't want to be sort of left on the sidelines of that, and sort of was brought to believe that it would be, you know, in out 20-minute adventure, he would wipe out the nuclear program and that would be done. Mm. We, of course, know it's far more complicated than that. You know, where the nuclear program goes from here, unclear. It's not a rosy assessment. Again, I talked to Joe Trincioni yesterday. It'll be out next week for an hour about this exact issue. And again, the second and third order consequences of Operation Midnight Hammer. I don't think it was a distraction. I mean, I think they can do two things at once.
Yeah. And do you think Trump has made Bush's mistake of saying mission accomplished before it was accomplished?
Yes. Okay. So there's something interesting about this here. And right after I finished up with Shane the other day, I sort of thought about this, and I was like, yeah, shit, I could have wanted to run this by him and see what he thinks. But okay. So the official line from the White House and at least the sort of top level of the Pentagon Hegseth sort of staff, right? That like the Iranian nuclear program, it was total obliteration. They don't have one anymore. You know, like this is done, which was entirely born out of Trump and Hegseth coming out that very night and saying things about the damage assessments that they could not have possibly known at that time, right? But now, okay, they said it. We can't walk back on it. This is what it is. And to say anything other than the nuclear program is totally gone and obliterated is high blasphemy. Right.
Yeah.
The Spanish Inquisition will show about your door if you say anything else, you know. So the interesting thing here then is because of that, right, the total obliteration thing is injecting a lot of de-escalatory pressure that I think without that, the case to do another strike at Fordo, to say nothing of any of the other sites, but Fordo especially, right, would be, I am not making this case, but I'm saying the case to do so would be being made by allies of the president and would be quite compelling, I think. It would definitely be part of it would be a thing right now if it wasn't high blasphemy. You know, the Spanish Inquisition is going to show up at your door if you say anything other than it was totally obliterated. So I think that's interesting. It also, you know, you see statements from, like, you know, Caroline Leavitt, the White House press secretary and everything, who's just very, you know, black and white. Like, no, the nuclear program is gone. They're never going to get a nuclear bomb. present her and other Trump people saying this are potentially not doing any favors to future them, right? Because there's no guarantee at all. I mean, they may insist it's all they want. I don't give a shit. They're wrong about this. There is no guarantee that a year or two from now that there won't be some mysterious earthquake 10 kilometers underground in under a desert in central Tehran and in central Iran somewhere, or perhaps right up on the surface and just, you know, light a bomb off as like a demonstration, right? So when that happens, what are you going to say? You were so confident, insistent that the nuclear program is gone, that you're never going to get a nuclear bomb. Like you're not doing yourself any favors by staking this impossible totalitarian claim. It's just so, it's so short-sighted and just impulsive and just strategically dumb. Like you're not helping yourself.
Yeah, it's very ego-driven and bravado, isn't it? I kind of call it man-child kind of energy. Really, it's very weird. And I guess then they'll have to go through the process of renaming the nuclear program and calling it something else just to save face.
It's like, right. It's not a nuclear program.
Like a rapid disassembly. Yeah.
Right. It's not a nuclear program. It's an atomic critical mass weapons development project.
Something like that, yeah. Yeah, right. It was rapidly disassembled underground.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It was a mining accident on Jeddah.
That's... Well, we'll take bets now and see what happens in a few years' time and see what it either gets called and if it happens. But is there anything else you'd like to add? Or
No, that's... Yeah. Yeah, again, not a lawyer, not a legal scholar, not an expert in this, but that's sort of what I could put together on how this all works and why we are the way we are.
Okay, well, thank you for that. Well, let's take another break and we'll be back with more. So welcome back, everybody. So our final story today, we're going to be just talking a little bit about Ukraine, which it's been a bit, it's not been quiet for Ukraine, but certainly reporting sort of taken a bit of a back foot lately just with all that's been going on with Iran. So I wanted to just bring our attention back to Ukraine because I think I've said this before, my goal with this podcast is to draw attention to many things. And try not to forget stuff because we can get very focused in the news cycles, certainly in the UK and the US, about very particular things for weeks and then other things suffer. So just some key points from a Warzone article about some fighting that's going on in the northern borders of Ukraine. So Ukraine has successfully stabilized the situation in Sumy Oblast, halting Russia's summer offensive. Despite Russia committing 50,000 troops and some of its best units, Ukrainian forces have stopped their advance along the key frontline villages and push Russian troops further from Sumy city. Moscow's broader goal is to create a buffer zone along Ukraine's border regions whilst trying to expel Ukrainian forces from Russia's Kursk and Belgorod. Although Russia claimed it had cleared Kursk of Ukrainian troops earlier this year, those claims were later disputed by both Ukraine and even some Russian officials. For now, President Zelensky says the Russian plan in Sumy is failing thanks to the efforts of Ukrainian forces. The battle for Sumy has come at a high cost. Ukrainian troops have had to dig fresh defensive positions under constant drone and artillery fire whilst retreating from Kursk, and they've been finding outdated trenches and weak fortifications. And there's been criticism of not actually placing mines for anticipating Russian tanks and artillery. So it's definitely, this battle for Sumy has sort of created some sort of internal debate with regards to Ukraine's military and certain tactics and things. So I'm sure that will come up again at some point in the near future. Meanwhile, Russia has suffered significant losses in troops and equipment, but it continues to pour in reserves and heavy firepower. And the article points out that Russia sadly has the manpower to keep throwing people at Ukraine whilst Ukraine doesn't. So Ukraine have to kind of fight a lot more carefully and smarter. Drone warfare remains fierce. Ukraine is using heavy lift drones to drop artillery shells in Russian positions, and they continue to target Russian air defenses in Crimea to open gaps over the Black Sea. And on the flip side, Russia is advancing missile naval guns to target Ukrainian drone boats. Ukraine is frustrated by the delays in military aid, and it's now starting to develop its own ballistic missile, which it already apparently has in mass production. So, you know, well done for Ukraine for doing that. So I'm hoping that will probably become operational soon. Elsewhere along the front lines, fighting remains largely static. Small Ukrainian advances have been reported in the east, but no major breakthroughs. Meanwhile, Russia has launched its largest aerial attack of the war, firing hundreds of drones and missiles. And then Ukraine's air defenses have downed many, but at least 10 civilians were killed and an F-16 pilot was killed defending against Russia's recent assault. So, yeah, Matt, what are your thoughts on all of this?
You know what stood out to me wasn't just the troop movements, it was how unprepared some of Ukraine's defenses reportedly were after their retreat from Kursk, what's left of that pocket in Kursk, back to Sumy. So outdated trenches, no overhead cover from drones, unmined terrain. I think it's a reminder that even Ukraine's sort of best fighters can't hold without the right gear.
Especially
when Russian artillery is creeping closer and closer and closer. And it comes, of course, as we're learning, you know, that the Trump administration, I think this came out yesterday or the day before. It's all sort of blended together for me this week. But we're learning that the Trump administration is freezing, at least for now, key weapons shipments, part of a broader military aid review. The Pentagon says it's concerned about U.S. stockpiles running too low. So reportedly, the pause shipments include PAC-3, interceptors, HIMARS munitions, 155-millimeter artillery shells, even sidewinders that Ukraine retrofits into its so-called Frankensam air defense systems. In short, it's exactly the kind of weapons that allow Ukraine to hold ground, survive drone and missile attacks, and keep units like the GUR commandos in the fight. So, I mean, that aid freeze isn't abstract. Its consequences are being felt in real time on battlefields like Sumy. And if this becomes a sustained push from Russia, the lack of resupply could mean the difference between a stabilized front and a breakthrough there in the northeast, I guess you would say. So Ukraine may be holding a line for now. They tend to make do and find a way. The rumors of their death are always sort of greatly exaggerated and overstated. But I mean, that's not to say that they can just get through it no matter what. So yeah, Ukraine may be holding the line for now, but even elite units can only hold for so long without replenishment. And this is the kind of fight, the defense of Sumy, that I think policymakers at the top of the Pentagon need to see for what it is, not just a shopping list from Kyiv, but a battlefield reality, one that shows sort of exactly where this aid is going and what happens when it runs out.
Yeah, it's incredibly disappointing to hear about that the US have paused the delivery of crucial US air defense systems. And one of the talking points that come out as well is that the reasoning behind this is because the US wants to shift its focus to Asia. And apparently, is it defense? The Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Elbridge Colby, is a strong proponent of shifting American focus to Asia.
Son of a former CIA director.
Oh, is it? Yeah. As in, is that William Colby?
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Interesting.
Son
interesting.
Or grandson.
Yeah, it might be a grandson, maybe.
Offspring, descendant.
Yeah. And it's the thing. I mean, it's the classic kind of, America can't just suddenly just shift its focus to Asia and pretend that there aren't other problems in the world. And, you know, Ukraine is definitely still very reliant on American support and will be for some time until sort of Europe can plug some of those gaps. But I think when it comes to missile defense, I don't think Europe will be able to plug that gap for at least a decade, probably, because those systems, I don't think Europe's really got any proper domestic missile defense at this time that isn't US made. And to develop that off the cuff is going to be incredibly difficult. So, you know, the Patriot missile system is world leading in that front, as is the Israeli Iron Dome as well. But yeah, sorry, you were going to say something.
Well, it's also just willful ignorance on the part of the people in the Pentagon who are sort of making these decisions as, oh, we want to focus on Asia, so we're going to sort of pull this stuff out of Ukraine, as if the two are not inextricably linked. That, you know, what happens in Ukraine has absolutely an impact on China's calculus vis-a-vis Taiwan and,
yeah, totally.
You know, islands in the South China Sea and the Philippines and Japan. Like, it's not to say that I'm only going to focus on this and let this other thing go, and that's not going to have any negative consequences for this other thing that I want to focus on. It's just like, that's not, how do you not see that?
No, exactly. And how will the people of Taiwan think about American support when things get tough? Because they might not be able to guarantee it anymore.
Yeah.
Because if a president sort of, may not be necessarily Trump, is whoever succeeds Trump in 5 or 10 years' time, if they have a very similar kind of isolationist approach that's inspired by MAGA, they might decide, oh, do you know what? You know, Taiwan's too much of a risk to getting into a conflict with China. Let's just stop, you know, let China do its thing. Because in a way, that's the message that they are sending about Ukraine at the moment. Things are getting tough. It's going on longer than Trump wants it to. It's making Trump look bad somehow. So let's just pretend it's not happening. A bit like COVID in some ways, you know,
yeah.
Because somehow COVID became a personal front to Trump. And that is dangerous when that happens. That's when politics gets very dangerous and people lose lives. So I'm deeply frustrated about what's going on with Ukraine, because I think the problem is, you know, again, like America stopped its support a little while back, using it as a negotiation tactic in the ongoing peace talks, with quotation marks for those who are not watching. And all that does is help Russia. It's not helping Ukraine. If anything, America should be increasing and maybe even doubling what it's giving to Ukraine to force Russia to come to the table. But for some reason, when it comes to dealing with Russia, Trump becomes a bit soft. And not to imply that, you know, I know some people think he might be a Russian stooge or whatever. I think he's just an admirer of Putin. But I think Putin is outsmarting Trump is what I think is going on. And I think Trump, just for whatever reason, gets very weak at the knees around Putin, and hasn't done much to really push things. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Butterflies in his stomach.
And I just think that he needs to take a maximalist position, which is what Trump's famous for, against Russia, and see where we go from there. But, you know, I don't see that happening anytime soon. So there we go. So,
It's interesting. There was sort of before Iran sort of sucked up a lot of the bandwidth. And it seems like there's only like one thing internationally that they're able to focus on at a time. And perhaps because the NSC is like Marco Rubio doing like the dinner scene from like The Nutty Professor.
I feel sorry for him.
They can only sort of focus on like one thing at a time, it seems, which is objectively not good for a superpower. That's not supposed to be that way. But, you know, before Iran took up all the bandwidth, there was sort of a bit of a rumbling that, you know, Trump is sort of pissed with Putin and he's not happy with the way things are going and yada, yada, yada. And then Iran showed up and that sort of, again, you know, took the attention away. Let's get back there, guys. Let's revisit that.
I agree, and I remember Keir Giles talk about that it requires a certain amount of period to try and deal with Putin before you get annoyed with him, because Macron tried to deal with him and then it didn't work out. But my only thought on that is, with Trump, he's already dealt with Putin once before, but I suppose he hasn't dealt with him in a conflict. So it's
not under these circumstances. I think you know, the aspects of their relationship, the sort of pressure points and everything in the first term, is just nothing like it is. Like it is here.
We'd go by Trump's comments about Netanyahu and the Iranians when they violated the ceasefire that Trump had somehow brokered without telling anybody. And it was violated quite immediately. You know, maybe we'll see him, pushing the F-bomb towards Putin, you know. That would be interesting to see. So, joking aside, stuff, obviously, it's very serious for Ukraine. I always feel very concerned for them, and I really, you know, wish them all luck, because it just is an existential threat for them as a country at the moment. And I think, you know, like you were talking about earlier about how they managed to somehow pull through, and I guess it's just because they've got no other choice. And what is interesting is their use of drones is leading some very new, it's leading to new ways of warfare. You know, there are already probably studies about Operation Spiderweb and et cetera. And I think that, you know, Ukraine, through its desperate measures, have been very innovative and effective. So,
The Ukrainians are fighting for something, whereas the Russians are not. And I mean, there are all sorts of examples throughout history of armies that have prevailed against impossible odds because they were fighting for something when their opponents fundamentally were not, you know?
Yeah, indeed. Is there anything else you'd like to add, or are you happy there?
Nope.
Cool. I'll just sort of quickly, very quickly do the stories of note and then we'll wrap us up. So just before we finish today, I just wanted to point out two stories of note that we're not going to cover, but I think are definitely worth looking into, and they'll be in the show notes. So the first one is about MI5 and legal troubles. So the High Court has ordered a robust and independent new investigation into how MI5 gave false evidence to multiple courts after rejecting two official inquiries provided by the security service as seriously deficient. The two reviews took place after the BBC revealed MI5 had lied to three courts in a case concerning a neo-Nazi state agent known publicly as Agent X. And Agent X was accused of abusing women. So Agent X is an undercover source for MI5, presumably recruited due to his access to a neo-Nazi group of interest. And it appears MI5 gave false evidence to prevent details of Agent X becoming public, despite the BBC reporting of him being a serial abuser of women. So that's definitely a case to keep an eye on, and I'm hoping maybe in time, in future episodes, we might well cover that, because that's a kind of ongoing story in the UK at the moment, and quite a concerning one. I don't know if anything has come across in America about that at all, but it might be just a very domestic story at this time.
Yeah. No, we were on the phone the other day and you mentioned this to me, and that was the first I heard of it. Of course, I haven't been looking for it, but I have not seen it come across.
No, my radar. In many ways, it doesn't surprise me. It's sort of, it does seem quite a British story, that, but it's definitely one for us to keep an eye on. And the last one to keep an eye out is on the Chinese Akrana plans. So there's new reporting from Naval News that indicates that China is building Akrana plans. And we mentioned this just a few weeks ago on Espresso Martini, that Russian intelligence was suspicious of Chinese espionage efforts, especially around military secrets. And one point of interest was apparently Akrana plans. And lo and behold, a few weeks later, we find out China are actually building them. So presumably, this is for their ambitions to take Taiwan by force, or at least to show that they've got the capability to do it. But we will see what happens with China's Akrana plan program. And for those who don't know what an Akrana plan is, it's a type of low-flying aircraft that skims just above the water's surface using ground effect to achieve high speed, and it can take heavy loads. And it looks like a cross between a plane and a boat, and it's ideal for moving troops and equipment under radar. And there's a really great documentary, which I think you can find on YouTube, that I believe from memory the BBC made, called the Caspian Sea Monster, and it goes into the Akrana plan program, because honestly, fascinating, it really is. And the Chinese ones that I've seen look very similar to the later Russian ones that never became operational. The Caspian Sea Monster, I think it was known as. So
We'll have to look more. We'll have to look into this more in the future, because there was also, I don't know enough about it off the top of my head to sort of go into it right here and now, but there was a reason why the Soviet Akrana plan program failed. I mean, it was like a sort of good ambitious idea, but there was a reason why it didn't work.
Timing as well, because it was kind of late in the 70s to mid 80s that it finally was successful, and then obviously things fell apart, so there was an element of that too.
Just
maybe we should do an Akrana plan special. I'm well up for that. Just gonna find the right person, experts on them. I don't know how many experts there are on Akrana plans these days.
There's gotta be a guy for that.
Yeah, it's got to be. So we'll find the Akrana plan person. And if anybody knows an expert on Akrana plans, please drop us an email. So thank you, Matt, for your time today. Thank you, everybody, listening. That is us for today. But don't forget, you can connect with us on Blue Sky and Instagram. Those are our main socials that we operate on. But we are also on Threads. And officially our account on X is mothballed, but you never know, it may or may not get reactivated in time, but there we go. So thank you for your time, Matt. You up to anything exciting this weekend?
Tomorrow, as we're recording, is the 4th of July.
Yes, happy 4th.
Thank you.
I completely forgot about that too.
Don't forget it.
Don't worry, I'm sure we'll be reminded of it over social media and won't be able to forget it. But
My favorite 4th of July, I think I've told this story on here before. My favorite 4th of July ever was getting really drunk at a pub in London. And it was like, everyone knew that it was 4th of July and I was there, and everyone was in on the joke too. We all had a good laugh at it and everything. But yeah,
what year was that? Because I remember getting drunk in a pub in 2013 with an American friend of mine, and then getting involved in some sparkler incident that could have got way out of hand. That thankfully didn't.
No, this was 2011.
Okay, 2011. That's before mine. Yeah, because I think that's my happiest 4th of July memory as well. Mm-hmm. It's in a pub drunk mm-hmm. somewhere in London.
Everyone in central London within earshot of me knew damn well that it was the 4th of July and that I was here.
Excellent, excellent. Well, you'll have to take that to the Mayflower pub next time you come here. So that, mm-hmm. that's a good place mm-hmm. for that. But there we go. So anybody out there who's celebrating 4th of July, have a wonderful weekend. Do not get sunburnt, you know, and behave responsibly and consume a safe amount of hot dogs if that's what you're going for. I don't know, what is the sort of staple for 4th of July food? Is it hot dogs or something else?
It's sort of, you know, the sort of classic Americana, you know, barbecue food. I think you could kind of loop any of that into there. I think we're doing some ribs in the oven and corn and baked beans and some other
salad, because I could hear that gets quite political if you're not careful.
I think that's on the menu.
There's some strong opinions about potato salads, but yeah.
I recall hearing that come up in conversation. But yes, there are. People have very different ways of making potato salad, some far more barbaric than others. And everyone sort of has their preferred way, and don't you dare try to variate from it. But
yeah, no, indeed. What's your preferred method?
I like potato salad. I've never really made it and never really had to. So I don't know. As long as there isn't like weird stuff in there, you know. Mm. Of course, I'm not even going to say what weird stuff I mean when I say that, because someone's going to hear that and be like, what do you mean?
Like a prawn or something. You know?
Yeah. My Nana made it that way for 50 years in healthcare. I'm not even going to go there. You can imagine what I, you know, what do you think I mean when I say weird stuff in potato salad? That can be your reality of what you think I mean there. I'm not going to go there.
Yeah, indeed. Well, my mother used to make a lovely one I used to think it was lovely, but it was the one I kind of grew up on, which is obviously cooked potatoes that now diced up with a little bit of onion and salad cream, and then all mixed together. And because salad cream is quite sweet, it's different from mayonnaise. It's kind of sweet, and it's a sort of mustardy sweet thing, and it gives it a yellow color. And it's actually quite nice. But many people probably hearing this thinking, "My God, that's the worst sounding thing I've ever heard of." So each to their own with potato salad. What about beer of choice? Any beers or drinks of choice?
I'm going to have to stop tomorrow morning. I'm not sure what I'm going to get. Probably stick with beer. In the summer, I'm sort of a Corona guy. In the colder months, I stick to Guinness. And in the summer, I sort of go with Corona. So I'm sort of, it's either one or the other for me. It's just sort of my standard to go to.
Yeah, nice. I've always been a big fan of Sierra Nevada Pale Ale. It's got a nice sort of flavor to it, and very refreshing when cold. I love Guinness. I've recently got into Woodford Reserve, which turns out to be one of the FBI's drinks of choice, I found out. So that's quite nice.
If I could turn this camera that way, you would see a bottle of Woodford Reserve over there. Yeah.
Not for the faint-hearted. It's quite strong in flavor, but, you know, you definitely feel it once you've had some, but I like it. I like it a lot. Yeah. Yeah. Well, there we go. So potato salad, whiskey and beer recommendations right there for you. And we're not sponsored by anybody. So we should be. But there we go. Right. Well, on that note, thank you very much, everybody, for listening. Have a great weekend, 4th of July or not. And we'll catch you on the next one. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. This is Secrets and Spies.